Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg from the Allstate Studios in Chicago on 720 WGN.
The real truth about religion is that it never holds completely stable and consistent. It changes over time. It changes in response to influences. It changes in response to strong figures who produce the change by new theologies, even by new narratives. Why do I mention all of that now? Because we're going to be looking at a kind of a slide in time of the shape of Judaism and to some degree of Christianity as revealed by the Dead Sea Scrolls. The Dead Sea Scrolls were written and were hidden away over about a 100-year period. We'll talk about that almost instantly as we ask where they came from, when they were found, what they tell us. I'm going to ask that of two Dead Sea Scrolls scholars who have been here in town for a great meeting of people of that scholarly specialization. My guests are James C. Van de Kam, who is professor in this realm of work at the University of Notre Dame, and Craig A. Evans, who does the same line of work at Acadia University in Nova Scotia. Though, to be sure, James Van de Kam specializes in the Old Testament relevance of the Dead Sea Scrolls, and Craig Evans specializes in the New Testament relevance of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Well, let us first come. I think we begin this by telling the story of the Bedouin boy who throws a rock into a cave in the year 1947. Is that right? Mm-hmm.
Yes, that's the most commonly accepted story about the discovery of the scrolls. Apparently, this Bedouin shepherd was taking a break from working with his animals and tossed a rock into a cave opening. And instead of just hearing a rock clank against a rocky wall, he heard a crash. And he didn't immediately go in to investigate what had broken, but a couple days later, apparently, he's wiggled his way into this small cliff opening and found a number of vases, in one of which, at least, were some scrolls. And so this was the first discovery of Dead Sea Scrolls, and many were to follow over the next 9 years. But that was the initial story.
Now, and where, Craig Evans, is that cave located?
Well, it's very close to the Dead Sea, the sea that continues to shrink and get smaller every year now. Mm-hmm. And at the northwest corner, you might say, of the Dead Sea, and that's the place we call Qumran. And it was the first of what would turn out to be 11 caves that were found to contain these related scrolls.
How soon was it recognized, and by whom was it recognized, that these scrolls were what they were, that they were important and had bearing upon the history of Judaism?
That took quite a while to sink in. The Bedouin didn't really know what they had with these particular scrolls, and they contacted people they knew who were interested in antiquities. In fact, in Bethlehem was one place. And eventually they came to the attention of scholars in Jerusalem an Israeli scholar, Eliezer Sukenik, for example, identified, saw what these were, very ancient Hebrew documents, and others did as well. But it took some time to recognize.
And what were those documents? In the first jar, as found by the Bedouin boy, what was on the scroll?
Well, one of them, probably the most famous scroll, is the great Isaiah scroll, all 66 chapters.
The book of Isaiah.
Of the book of Isaiah. It's a beautiful scroll, and it's very, very good condition.
And scholarly examination, which took quite a while, discovered and demonstrated that it was virtually the same text as you have in the what was previously the earliest one we had, the Masoretic text that dated for about 1,000 years later.
No, that's right. The text is very close. There are some differences, but it's very close.
Meaning that the Old Testament really was written a long time ago.
It's a tribute to the accuracy and the care that Jewish scribes took in copying these books. there are actually quite a number of small differences, I would say, mostly very small differences that don't affect the meaning of the text. But it is a remarkably well-preserved text over many, many centuries of hand copying.
When did the archaeologists and the other scholars begin to descend upon the area looking for other caves with other scrolls?
Well, the situation was very tense in that part of the world when the scrolls were found. And so that hindered the archaeological investigation for some time. And the cave itself was not located by anyone other than the Bedouin and people whom they showed it to until early 1949. And then some excavations took place by archaeologists. But there was quite a delay there between the initial discoveries and the first excavation.
But ultimately, this becomes a kind of an industry, does it not?
Yes.
Well, yes, of course. And hunting for new caves, you might say, was an industry. And that's what led to several of them being found by Bedouin. But scholars began to find them, too, especially as work got underway where the ruins are located, the Kerbet Qumran, which is, of course, now a tourist place. You can go and look at the ruins and be guided around and see some of the caves.
Now, when you talk about the ruins, we're talking about what may or may not have been the Essene Monastery.
Well, I know that's highly debated, and whether or not it should be called a monastery is another thing, because that almost sounds anachronistic. But I think the traditional understanding that this was a particular group known to writers like Josephus from the first century and Philo and others, a group called the Essenes, I think that they are to be identified with those ruins and the scrolls that were found nearby.
There was a time shortly after the discoveries and after some of the early scholarship was done when a fellow named Dupont de Somme, a Frenchman, I think a Catholic priest, was he?
I don't recall if he was a priest.
But he wasn't one of the seven priests who really had full control in a location in East Jerusalem when that was still belonged to Jordan. That's where all the early scrolls were stored up, I believe. But Dupont Somme studied them and came to the view that, that yes, these were Essenes. They were a Jewish sort of apocalyptic and puritanical community of men only living in that location, and that quite likely Jesus was among them, and that the what's the term used in one of those Essene scrolls?
The teacher of righteousness.
The teacher of righteousness may well have been Jesus himself.
Yeah. Well, he drew very strong parallels between Jesus and the teacher of righteousness, and thought that we could really understand the origins of Christianity best by looking at this particular group.
That either Jesus was the teacher of righteousness or that was the model
yes,
that Jesus followed.
Right, the model, I think, that Jesus was very much like, the experience of Jesus was very much like the experience claimed for this teacher of righteousness.
So that Jesus would have sort of got the idea of being Jesus by having read the Essene material.
Yeah, there was a very close association between the two.
And somebody who really bought that hypothesis from Dupont Somme was the great American literary critical figure, Edmund Wilson, who did a book that popularized that whole view.
Yes, that's right. And but I think the problem with that view was that our materials were so limited. We were drawing close comparisons and connections when we didn't realize that they were larger patterns. And so there was no need to make that one-to-one correlation. Mm-hmm. Just because there happened to be some approximate parallels in the scrolls doesn't mean that, therefore, Jesus must have been a member of the Essene community.
Well, you and a few hundred or more colleagues for the last 50 years, not that you two have been at it for 50 years, you're a bit younger than that, but for 50 years, this scholarly community of biblical archaeologists and biblical scholars generally have been studying, finding the scrolls, deciphering them, studying them, and asking how do they relate to the history of our religions, the religions of the peoples of the book, namely the Jews, the Christians, and to be sure, the Muslims. We have to mention them as well and ask whether we learn anything about the origins of Islam from the Dead Sea Scrolls. And we'll continue with all of that after we pause for this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
My guests tonight, both biblical scholars of very high repute, are Craig Evans of Acadia University in Nova Scotia and James C. Vanderkam of the University of Notre Dame. We've talked about the scrolls, just assuming everybody knows about them. Everybody has heard the term. But physically, how would one describe what they are?
Well, the scrolls are leather, mostly, and they're rolled up, and that's why they're called scrolls, although many of them are in fragments, like confetti. There are about 900 of them, and they've been found in 11 caves, although in Cave 4, about two-thirds of them were discovered, and they represent several different genres or types of writing.
You say they're on leather, but they flake off a lot. There's been a lot of problem with mere fragments with only a letter or two on them.
Yeah, that's right. And we can't do anything with those fragments, but many of the fragments are large, and we can reconstruct at least partially some of the scrolls. And sometimes we have multiple copies. And so what's missing in one scroll might not be missing in a duplicate scroll.
How big are the scrolls? We're sitting right here. I'm raising my hand. How tall and how thick?
They're not that tall, usually. You know, they're perhaps a large one would be, you know, more than 12 inches
in height.
In height, yes. They're length.
And when they're rolled out?
When they're rolled out, the most complete ones that we have extend to about 24, 25 feet or
That's
so.
That's a lot.
Because a number of sheets have been sewn together to make for the book of Isaiah, which is a very long book. You need quite a few sheets for that.
And is that the form in which documents of any sort of length were commonly worked up in those days?
That was a very popular way.
They didn't have
to do
bound
it.
Books of the sort that
right,
we've
the
got.
Codex came along later than the scrolls. So this was the common way, and we have references to people, you know, for example, Jesus in the synagogue at Nazareth opens the scroll of Isaiah that is handed to him. This was the common way to have long text, longer text, you know, that took more than one sheet.
Now, who put them there, really?
Well, we believe that this group called Essenes, whatever that originally meant, it might have meant doers, that is, those who do the law or keep the covenant. But anyway, we believe that this library was collected. Doesn't mean they wrote all of them. Some of the writings are distinctive to them. They collected books, scripture books, and wrote commentaries and rule books about how to behave and other things like that. But we believe that it was this group called Essenes who gathered these writings. And then in desperation, I think, as a Roman army approached, hid them in some of these caves.
Now, you know that we've got a colleague at the University of Chicago, another eminent scholar, Norman Golb, who argues that the Essenes may have been there, but they aren't the guys who really put them away. Or maybe they just received it, but they received it from Jerusalem. Because the Romans were coming on. This is close to 70 A.D. when the Romans come and take over and destroy the Second Temple. And this was a way of hoarding or safekeeping by hiding away very important documents from very important, essentially theological libraries in Jerusalem.
Right.
And isn't that the Golb thesis?
Right. That is what Professor Golb has argued. That these are scrolls that were in Jerusalem, were brought out here for safekeeping. That's not a very widely accepted position because the scrolls, if they did come from Jerusalem, you might think they would reflect the diversity of Judaism at the time and perhaps more of a Pharisaic standpoint if the Pharisees were as dominant as Josephus suggests they were. But
The Essenes are quite different from the Pharisees.
They are distinct from the Pharisees.
What's the nature of the distinction?
The primary distinction is that the Essenes had a, we might say, stricter understanding of how to obey the law of God than they regarded the Pharisees as more moderate, or more relaxed in their
modernizers, liberals.
Right. They were people who adapted the ancient law to modern circumstances, you know, so that one could practice the law in their own day.
Josephus mentions three major traditions. Mm-hmm. We've spoken of two of them, the Essenes and the Pharisees. There are also the Sadducees.
Right.
What were the Sadducees in relation to the other two we've mentioned? Mm-hmm. How did they differ?
Well, the Sadducees, from the descriptions that we have in Josephus, he says that they are usually they were not followed by the majority of people. They were perhaps a more wealthy group, perhaps a more conservative group.
They're sort of the temple elite, aren't they?
Well, it's often claimed that they were a temple elite. whether that's entirely accurate, I don't know. Some high priests were Sadducees, but I don't think all of them were.
But the Essenes are clearly sort of the puritanical bunch. And they also have wilder ideas, don't they? Ideas of a coming eschatological end of time, an idea which has penetrated Christianity over the...
I think a lot of their eschatology had to do with restoration of the temple and Israel on their terms, as they believed it should be, and a priesthood that would be reestablished probably according to the Zadokite family line, which they believed was appropriate, normative. And so I'm not really sure it meant end of the world or something like that, as we moderns sometimes imagine, but more of a restoration of Israel along the lines that it was supposed to be.
There was also a concept of a Messiah to come.
Oh, yes, yes. And my belief is that the Messiah they anticipated would strongly support their understanding of temple purity and the right high priest. And so the Messiah was an important figure, but I don't think they saw him as any way unusual. He would just be supportive of their agenda.
But at some point, they take all of these scrolls and they hide them and they run. They abandon the location at which they're living, at the Dead Sea. Is it simply because the Romans are coming?
Well, that's a hypothesis. We don't know, frankly. But it's around that time when the Romans were suppressing the Jewish revolt, which went from 66 to 70 A.D. And perhaps in the year 68, a Roman legion was in this area. So it's thought likely that given the signs of destruction of battle that took place in that area, that perhaps a Roman troop did, in fact, attack this site and destroy it. And the approach of the Romans may well have been the occasion that led people to hide these scrolls in the caves, assuming they could find them afterwards.
So it's like another Masada, except the Romans didn't have to climb a very high mountain.
Right. But of course, they never came back to retrieve the scrolls, and so they remained in those caves for many, many centuries.
Did we have any knowledge? Was there any lore around that there are hidden documents someplace out there near the Dead Sea? Before the first were found, I mean.
Yes, actually we do. From antiquity, we have some of the church fathers referring to, like one actually refers to a scroll found in a jar somewhere near Jericho.
Uh-huh.
And I mean, it's we don't know for a fact, of course, but it's plausible that that actually was one of these hidden jars that someone found, and it wound up in the vicinity of Jericho. And and from a different century, there's a reference similar to that where a church official inquires, could there be some text, ancient text that he's heard circulating in the Holy Land that someone could look at and see if the Hebrew reads similarly to the way the Greek translation reads. So those to me are indications that some of these writings hidden away actually were circulating way before the 20th century when we had that remarkable find.
We've already noted that in an Essene document about the Prince of Light and the Prince of Darkness and so on, we seem to have a model that just might have inspired, or some argue it could have inspired, Jesus himself. There must be yet other implications or derivations that somehow bear upon the construction of that sector of Judaism which became Christianity, that reconstruction of Judaism in the Jerusalem synagogue or Jerusalem church, which became after Jesus was crucified and over the next 50 or 60 years shaped up into something that evolved as Christianity. I wonder what else we learn about the groundwork for Christianity or the modes of thought that may have been readily available to the first Christians, which are to be discovered in somehow some of the documents among the Dead Sea Scrolls. And I shall persist with that question as we continue, right after we pause right now for a full update on the evening's news.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
Two guests tonight, both very significant biblical scholars. James Vanderkam specializes in the Old Testament at the University of Notre Dame. Craig Evans specializes in the New Testament at Acadia University at their Divinity College in what's that town? Wolfville,
Nova Scotia, Eastern Canada.
Yeah. So since we're going to focus still a bit more on the New Testament and on the origins or the development of Christianity, what do people like you learn from the Dead Sea Scrolls about Christianity that was unknown before, say, 1947?
We learn a lot about the world in which Jesus grew up and in which he conducted his activities, his public activities, the world in which his disciples learned things and became active, and, of course, the founders of the church. And so we understand better how Scripture was interpreted. We actually have commentaries, and so we know. We don't have to guess. We actually know how Scripture was interpreted. We have some ideas about what the Messiah was supposed to be like, what he was expected to do, the nature of the conflict with Israel's enemies internally and externally, like the Romans. Also ideas about how the law was understood, how the Sabbath was to be kept, issues of purity, and so forth. And so this kind of information gives us a context to understand Jesus' own teachings, the things he said, the parables he told, how his life is then narrated in what we call the Gospels. We understand better what Paul was talking about in his letters. For example, he refers to the works of the law. We have that exact phrase in some letters found in Qumran's fourth cave. So it's this kind of information that is invaluable to those of us who study the New Testament and Christian origins.
Well, how does that change what we understood about Christian origins?
Well, for example, there's this one very important passage where Jesus seems to understand himself as the Messiah. John the Baptist is in prison. He wants to know if Jesus really is the one who is to come, or should they look for someone else? And then Jesus replies by saying, well, tell John that the blind regain their sight, and others are healed, and so forth, and the poor have good news preached to them. Then we find a text at Qumran in K4 where when the Messiah comes, these kinds of things happen. Well, this helps us understand that, you know what, Jesus' reply really was a messianic reply.
A great and persistent question, as you know, in the study of early Christianity is who did Jesus think himself to be? What was Jesus' understanding of who he was and of what his mission and purpose and origin was? As I told you before we began, that great question that Hans Kung once blundered into, lapsing into German on this program. Aber wer war diesem Jesu? Who was he, this Jesus? Who did he think he was?
Well, when Hans Kung was talking about that, he didn't know about this document from K4. It's document number 521. It's convinced me and a number of other scholars who at one time were skeptical about this question, did Jesus really think of himself as Israel's Messiah? Now it's hardly controversial in New Testament scholarship, and I mean critical scholarship, not necessarily confessional theology, but critical scholarship. Yes, Jesus probably did understand himself as Israel's anointed one, which is what Messiah means, because the parallels are just too close to push aside.
But what did Messiah mean in the Judea context at that time? There's that British rabbi who's also something of a New Testament scholar. I forget his name. Do you know him?
Geza Vermesh?
No, not Geza Vermesh. Another guy. And his book is in a book that he did some 30 years ago, and he talked about it on this program. His name begins with S. Other than that, I can't quite remember. He argues that Jesus was that Christianity was a political revolt, and that Jesus was really a revolutionary. And that was the meaning of messiahship. This is the way of getting rid of the Romans.
Well, what we have found is that different groups, different Jewish groups, had different ideas about what the Messiah is supposed to be. And there definitely were those groups who thought of Messiah as a military commander.
The name of the book is The Passover Plot.
Hugh Schoenfeld.
Schoenfeld.
And, you know, that's not taken very seriously by critical scholars. I mean, that was an imaginative plot, and Passover plots or theories of one nature or another have been spun for 40 years.
So as near as we can tell, Jesus thought of himself as?
I think he understood himself as the Lord's anointed in the sense of Isaiah 61, the prophecy about the Spirit of the Lord is upon me. He's anointed me to preach the gospel. And that's exactly what Jesus was doing.
But he wasn't an eternal part of the of the Trinity.
Well, that'd be anachronistic. I mean, Jesus is not thinking of the Chalcedon Creed or the Nicene Creed or something like that. But there is a sense in his teaching about his closeness to his Heavenly Father and an identity with him and an authority that he assumes. It doesn't surprise me that after the Easter event, his resurrection, that his immediate disciples and then their disciples and on down the line, that they begin to think of Jesus in divine terms. And that leads eventually to the Trinitarian idea.
You are both good believing Christians as well as very serious biblical scholars. I believe, Craig, you said you are a Baptist.
That's correct.
And James is a Presbyterian. Is that right?
Almost, yeah.
Or a Calvinist. A Calvinist, right. At least. So both of those traditions do have the Trinitarian, have the concept of the Trinity. Can you maintain your own belief in the Trinity, your own religious belief in the Trinity, or does your own work as a scholar necessarily make trouble for you there?
Well, I don't see that the scholarly work with texts like the Dead Sea Scrolls really has much to do with that particular question, you know, because the teachings about the Trinity, that's something that developed over time in Christianity.
Yeah.
And of course, we have in the Gospels, we have presentations of Jesus. And it's another question to say, well, what was the historical Jesus like? And then how is he presented in the different Gospels? And all of that, of course, has been a very controversial question, whether the Gospel writers, their concern was perhaps not primarily to reflect the historical Jesus, but to present a message about him. But at any rate, I really don't think that the holding to the doctrine of the Trinity, the Orthodox Christian doctrine of the Trinity, really has much to do with the scrolls, or it's not affected by it, I think, by the study of the scrolls.
Is there any other aspect of sort of contemporary Christian theology or Christian doctrine and dogma which is undermined by discoveries from the scrolls?
I don't think of doctrines being undermined, but I do think we have better evidence for some very important features of belief. You know, clearly, for Judaism, for Christianity, the scriptures are very, very important. And one of the major contributions that the scrolls have made, as we've talked about a little earlier, is to give us our very earliest copies of books in the Hebrew Bible or the Old Testament, and to show how in most cases it's been transmitted so very, very carefully over a long period of time. You know, that's obviously a very important contribution. It's not something that undermines any belief, I think, regarding the scriptures mm-hmm. in Judaism or Christianity, but it provides us with more evidence on which to go.
I am a Jew, not necessarily a profoundly religious one, but culturally strongly identified as such. I've got some Jewish education. I must, assuming that there is real genetic continuity across the millennia, and more recently there has been some DNA evidence to suggest that there is, then I had an ancestor, I trust, in Babylon during the captivity. And they practiced a kind of Judaism. It's available in the Babylonian Talmud, I suppose. I'm not sure. So the Babylonian Talmud is possibly dated later than that. But I'm sure that the Judaism of my ultimate forebears back 2,500 years ago or more must have been quite different from the Judaism that I learned something of as a boy and that I sometimes read about and with some special interest. We're about to pause for the usual reasons. When we return, let's look at Judaism and the way in which it was shaped, as revealed through close study of some, indeed many, of the scrolls found near the Dead Sea. And that's an assignment for James Vanderkam. When we return after this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we return to Professors Craig Evans of Acadia University and James Vanderkam of the University of Notre Dame, who the latter specializes in the Judaic meanings and the Judaic angles of the Dead Sea Scrolls. And, of course, that's much more evident than the possible Christian meanings, isn't it?
Right. All the scrolls are Jewish documents. Texts, right. Yeah. They're Jewish texts. And that's an important thing, I think, for all of us to remember, even though they have important implications for the origins of Christianity. They are Jewish texts. So no New Testament character is mentioned in the scrolls. This is a Jewish phenomenon. And they have made really important contributions. I think everyone recognizes that, to our understanding of what was happening in Judaism in the last century B.C., the first century A.D. We have a better picture of what things were like, the diversity that was present at that time, than we had before the scrolls were found. And in particular, you know, if these people who were associated with the scrolls were Essenes, we know a lot more about this Essene group and have a lot more of their writings than we do from any other group from that time.
So I gather then there's a fair amount of conflict and disputation between at least those three parties we've just named.
That's right. It's clear from the scrolls that they have opponents, Jewish opponents. They disagree with them about the proper interpretation of the law, how one obeys God in the appropriate way. They call them by various names, but we think they mean the Pharisees, that they're their primary opponent, because they don't have the appropriate understanding of the law that has been revealed to this group. And the as for the Sadducees, we think, too, that they were a group that probably was opposed by these Essenes, even though the Essenes and the Sadducees probably had a view of the law that was closer together than with the Pharisees.
You remember before we went to commercials, I was playing around and I thought of my own forebear on the banks of the Babylon, weeping at the banks mm-hmm. of that would be around, what, 550 B.C.?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What was his Judaism like?
Well, we can find out some things about his Judaism from reading books in the Bible. They tell us some of the books of the Bible come from that period, and some come from later on in that period. And there was a long and distinguished history of Jewish people in Babylon that continued over the centuries, as we know from later texts. But one of the things that continues through to the present day that was very important then was Sabbath, you know, proper keeping of the Sabbath, mm-hmm. and what that might have entailed. You know, a certain understanding of the people of God, who the people of God were, and how they should be related to other people. Festivals, things of that sort, you know, have a long historical continuity.
But it was a temple religion even then, wasn't it?
Well, it had been.
The abduction.
Right.
From
when the
Jerusalem.
Babylonians destroyed Jerusalem in 587 and destroyed the temple as well. And it was later in the same century that Jewish people who were in Jerusalem rebuilt the temple with official approval, official Persian approval, a temple that stood for a long, long time until 20 B.C. So for many centuries it stood. And then a new, more splendid temple was built by King Herod. That lasted mm-hmm. until 70. So, yes, it was a temple-centered religion at the time.
It's commonly understood that rabbinical Judaism, of the sort that prevails today, descends from Pharisaism. Is that true?
Well, it seems to be a fairly complicated problem, but I think it's fair to say that the kind of Judaism we find in the rabbinic texts, like the Mishnah and the Talmuds,
yeah.
is closest to, let's say, the Pharisaic stream of Judaism from pre-destruction, pre-70 times. So that's there's the greatest continuity there. So that was the kind of Judaism that became dominant after 70 and continued to be dominant for some time mm-hmm. after that.
There are so many mysteries in the Old Testament itself. How are they illumined or how are they resolved through the study of the books of the scrolls from the Dead Sea? For example, there's that wonderfully strange book. I've always found it quite fascinating, Ecclesiastes, which is sort of cynical and modern in some ways and almost depressive.
Mm-hmm.
vanity of vanities, all is vanity, and so on. Dust thou art, and to dust returneth. Is that not from Ecclesiastes as well? What do we know about that book?
Well, there are some copies of it found among the scrolls, not very many, but a few. So they knew the book, exactly what they thought about it. We don't have any clear indication of what they thought about it, but at least they had it, and unlike the Book of Esther, for example. So
that's the only one that's missing.
That's correct, of the books in the Hebrew Bible or the Protestant Old Testament.
Yeah.
Yes, it's the only one that we don't have any even fragmentary copy of. You know.
But finding a scroll with the Book of Ecclesiastes on it doesn't tell you about who wrote it or how it was put together or why. There's still the mystery of authorship for many of those major books of the Bible.
Yes, that's right. Most of the books of what we call the Old Testament or the Hebrew Bible are anonymous. We really don't know who wrote them, and we don't always know when. We make educated guesses. They seem to reflect a certain time, history, culture. That's how we at least tentatively date them.
The most mysterious, and in some ways the most important and the most assertive of them all, is the very first one. It is the Book of Genesis. In the beginning, God created, etc. Surely there are parallels to that in other religions of the Middle East or elsewhere.
There are ancient Near Eastern texts that tell a lot of similar stories about creation, flood.
Zoroastrianism?
Well, I'm thinking of things that we've collected from the ancient Near East. We actually have texts from dating way back, even earlier than when the Old Testament writings were written down, that tell similar stories. It's usually a bunch of gods killing each other, and that out of that we have planets and people and the sun and everything else.
What religious traditions are you referring to there?
Well, I say ancient Near Eastern because I'm leaving the door open. It could be whether it's Sumerian or Mesopotamian or Ugaritic, you know, or different. But in the Middle East, or what we call the ancient Near East.
I've heard some scholar of religion, indeed, Irwin Goodenough. I don't know if you know that name.
Oh, sure, of course.
He was an elder colleague when I was a kid assistant professor at Yale. And Irwin Goodenough used to argue that there's an awful lot of Greek mystery religion in both Judaism and Christianity.
Yeah, and
the divided soul kind of idea, he said, comes right out of the Greek mystery religions of, say, the 5th or 6th century B.C.
Yeah, and whatever the influence of that might have been at some point in Judaism and Christianity, and probably in some places more than others, I think one of the important things that the scrolls have done is to show us that so much of Judaism and Christianity really do have their roots in Judaism of this Second Temple period, the time when the scrolls come from, that so much of what we know of from Rabbinic Judaism even and an earlier Judaism and Christianity can be explained from Jewish sources more easily, I think, than turning to the sorts of sources that he was dealing with, although he was dealing with certain places and times, a later time.
Of course, there are those who argue, I guess there's a book of this title, isn't there, The Jewishness of Jesus, or Jesus as Jew? That's a very common theme. So that Jesus, we are told by some at least, had no sense at the time of the crucifixion that he was anything but a Jew.
Well, the last 40 years, I think that's been a major advance in New Testament scholarship concerned with Jesus, the historical Jesus, is an appreciation for his Jewishness. Geza Vermesh was in some ways a forerunner in that. And so it's commonplace now. And to recognize, you know, drop this idea that Jesus somehow ought to be lifted up out of the Judaism of his day or something like that. And no, he should be interpreted fully in a Jewish context. But that does not, just to do that, doesn't then, we shouldn't lose sight of some of the truly distinctive features in his own preaching, his own teaching, his activities.
Distinctive features in his preaching, such as?
Well, he claims to have the authority to forgive sins. I find that quite remarkable. Not in the sense the way a priest might declare that sins are forgiven because you've gone through the cultic practice, you've brought a sin offering or something to the temple. But Jesus, there's an immediacy. He doesn't pray and ask God to heal somebody as some of the great charismatic rabbis would do. He simply declares that someone is clean or that's rise and walk or you have your sight returned. So there's an immediacy of his authority, forgiving sins, making pronouncements about the Sabbath, which in the Jewish world, as you know, that's a very important thing. So there are distinctive features in his proclamation and a refusal to give signs the way many of the failed contemporaries would do, promise to divide the waters of the Jordan River, for example, or make the walls of Jerusalem fall down or something like that. Jesus has none of that. There's no showboat kind of activity. And so because of the scrolls and other texts from antiquity, we have a better nuanced sense of where he fits in this picture and what really is distinctive and what really is not. And that's where the scrolls, I think, have made such an important contribution for Jesus' research.
Some English divine and scholar of some sort wrote a book years ago titled The First Christian, and it was a book about St. Paul, arguing that Christianity is Paul's doing.
Well, yes, there's some that they like to drive a wedge between Jesus and Paul and talk about Paul as the true founder of Christianity. He's the one that turned it into a Gentile religion, for example. And I think that those claims are greatly exaggerated. And there's some very competent New Testament scholarship in recent years that underscore the continuity between Jesus and his teaching and what we actually see in Paul's letters. One of the reason that you see these differences is Paul, of course, is trying to explain the Christian faith to, for the most part, to Gentiles. And so naturally, his illustrations, his ways of arguing, so on, are a bit different from what Jesus was doing because that's not what Jesus was doing. He was preaching to fellow Jews.
Now, there is a modern scholar, if scholar he be, finds evidence that Jesus was not really crucified, and that Jesus went off to France with Mary Magdalene, and they raised a family, which ultimately became, I think, the Merovingian dynasty.
That's
fascinating stuff. The man's name is Dan Brown, and let's see what he draws from when he asserts that he gets this from the Dead Sea Scrolls. After we return from a full update on this evening's news.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg from the Allstate Studios in Chicago on 720 WGN.
And we're most privileged tonight to have with us two leading biblical scholars. James Vanderkam is from the University of Notre Dame. He specializes in the study of ancient Judaism and the relevance of all the materials from the from Qumran, so to speak, to a proper understanding of what Judaism was then and how it evolved, and for that matter, from what it came. Craig Evans has the same general interest in those sources, but with a particular interest in Christianity and the shaping of Christianity. He, Craig Evans, being professor at Acadia University, or rather the Divinity College of that institution, in Nova Scotia. Well, there's this one other incipient or ambitious scholar who has something of the popular touch as well, Dan Brown, who in his book, The Da Vinci Code, acquainted us with a view already developed by yet others that Jesus was not, in fact, crucified, but somehow that was all a big gag or some sort of deception, and he wound up with Mary Magdalene in France, where they formed a family, and a great deal followed from all of that. And he says that there are clues to that hidden truth in the Dead Sea Scrolls. What does he turn to in the Dead Sea Scrolls to make that assertion?
Nothing that I know of. There's nothing like that in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Jesus is not referred to. Mary Magdalene's not referred to. Not one New Testament personage is referred to. There's just nothing to it. No serious scholar, no credible trained scholar takes any of that stuff seriously.
But he took it from some other guys. I forget their names. You remember them just before.
Well, they're no better trained than he was.
Who did a book arguing all of that, not in the form of a novel, but as nonfiction.
They were on this program.
35 years ago.
Yeah, you're referring to a book that came out in 1982 called Holy Blood,
Holy
Grail. Is
that what it was?
Yes. And
what are their names? Do you remember?
Yeah, Michael Bagent and Richard Lee and Henry Lincoln. Three of them actually worked together on that book.
Yeah.
And you need to understand, these guys are not biblical scholars. They're not historians. They don't know anything about that subject. And so biblical scholars of Hebrew Bible or New Testament or whatever, people with proper training in the languages and the history and the archaeology and so forth, they don't pay any attention to this. That's too bad. I guess perhaps we should. But it's the public that gets suckered with these kinds of things. They read about it and they think it actually is real scholarship, but it is not.
One thing that tended to foment or at least to stimulate such suspicion may well have been, do you agree with this? It's just, I've read somebody hypothesizing this, that for a while the Catholic Church had a virtual monopoly on the Dead Sea Scrolls. They were all held in this one location in East Jerusalem when that was still in Jordan, and all of the seven scholars who were doing the work were Catholic priests. So, and it was commonly rumored there's stuff in the Dead Sea Scrolls that invalidates some crucial aspects of Catholic dogma about the life and death of Jesus, and that's being hidden.
Yeah, there are a number of misperceptions that have been fairly popular. This idea that there was a Catholic or a Vatican conspiracy to cover up what was in the scrolls. And the way in which the Vatican was supposed to do this is because, as you indicated, there were priests on the team of scholars who were given the assignment to publish these scrolls. Not all of the members of that team were Catholic priests. A couple of them were, but not all of them. And also, there's no indication of any interest by the Vatican, and even if it was interested, how it could have done this, we don't know, how they influenced the work on the scrolls. And once people could argue things like that at one point and say there is a conspiracy to cover up what's in the scrolls, because it took a long time for many of the scrolls to be made available to the public. It took decades. And conspiracy theories arose under those kinds of circumstances, and this Vatican one was one of those. But once all of these scrolls were published and we could see what was in everything, it was clear that there was nothing to charges of this sort. There's nothing to those theories.
Where are the scrolls physically now?
The scrolls are, for the most part, in Jerusalem, under the control of the Israelis at the Israel Museum in Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
Until not too many years ago, most of them were housed at the Rockefeller Museum in East Jerusalem, but now they're at the Israel Museum, also in Jerusalem. There are a few in other places. For example, there are some in Amman, Jordan, and a few other places around the world, but almost all of them are there in Jerusalem.
And I gather they've all been photographed or videoed and are available to anybody. Is that the case?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, anything worth that you can read that has at least a word or two. Some fragments are so tiny, they're just fragments. We don't even know if there's
a
letter.
Are they on the internet? If I wanted to bring them up, could I do so on the screen right now?
I think most of it is available even online.
Yeah, where would you go?
Well, if you just Google with the Israeli Antiquities Authority has begun a process of making everything readily available through photographs, very good photographs, and also ones that one can work with and be linked to other kinds of information. But if you just go to the internet, you could find a lot of photographs of scrolls if you just put in the information.
Well, you're both still working with scroll material. That means that there must yet be questions that are in the mind but are not yet resolved or not yet properly organized into analyzable data. What are the outstanding issues that remain?
Well, it is true. They've all been published. They've all been translated and to a certain extent commented upon.
Yeah.
Photographs have been published and so on. But there are true contributions to the many fields they affect, like the Judaism of the time, Christianity, and so on. That sort of study has been going on for a long time, but it's very unlikely that we've discovered everything there is to discover about the links between Judaism and other kinds of Judaism and these scrolls. And There are some perennially debated topics like the archaeology of the site, the dating of these building ruins where these Essenes had their communal center, and even the nature of that collection of buildings is debated. There are a lot of debates about the cemetery located near these building ruins and exactly who might have been buried in those many individual tombs, and that affects, to a certain extent, estimates about how many people may have used that site. Was it just a few? Was it a couple hundred?
But are there persisting issues concerning the origin and then the development and the transformation of these two great religions, which might still be resolved by discoveries of this sort that is in the scrolls, or does one have to go to biblical physical archaeology and what you might dig out of the ground still yet undiscovered?
Well, the Dead Sea Scrolls, it's a large library. You have 900 texts, and if you subtract the 200 and some biblical scrolls, you still have almost 700 texts to study. Some of them are difficult to study because they're fragments, and so there are pieces missing, there are holes, and so that really hinders
interpretation. They're a jigsaw puzzle, so to speak.
But keep in mind, we continue to uncover in one place or another other texts that are related, intertestamental texts, mm-hmm. as we sometimes call them. They could be pseudepigraphal texts or apocryphal texts or something like that.
And that's a great word, pseudepigraphal. What does it mean?
Well, it means, you know, somebody pretending to be somebody isn't. So it's a, you know, it might be someone claiming it's an apocalypse by Moses or Elijah or somebody like that, but it really wasn't written by
or
that figure.
John writing the Book of Revelations.
Well, maybe so. But which John? John's a common enough name, so he might be John, but we just don't know which John he is. The other thing, too, Milt, is we have tens of thousands. Actually, the count is more like a few hundred thousand papyri from Egypt, not yet translated. I was simply blown away by a recent visit to Oxford and asked, well, how many papyri do you have to go? Is it going to be another 20 years?
Papyri said, from what time period?
We're talking about, 200 or 300 B.C., basically from the time shortly after Alexander the Great until the end of the Byzantine period, till about the 6th century. Thousands and thousands of papyri, not yet published. And as we sift through these, we continue to find fragments of New Testament writings, the Greek translation of the Old Testament. We have excavations, the archaeology part you've referenced. We estimate about 5% of the biblical world has been partially excavated. There's a lot of work left to do. So it isn't just all about the scrolls.
Yeah.
It's a massive contextual problem. And so the study will continue and go way beyond our lifetime, and on it'll go.
One thing that has often preoccupied me, and indeed which I try to teach about, though I don't know the answer at all, is the religious impulse, is religion as human creation. In fact, it seems to be universally done in all collectivities of any kind once they're established. Why and how, and are there any commonalities? And do those commonalities reveal some ultimate truth that we are trying to perceive and which is available for us? Or are they all somehow emanations of human nature rather than divine nature? I raise this rather irresponsibly right now. We're about to pause for some commercials, but I'd love to get your thoughts as religious scholars on these matters when we return after this.
This is Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
Before we do anything else, it is time to invite telephone calls. And the lines are open at this instant. The number is, of course, and it's a new, of course, because the number has been changed recently, as you know, if you're a regular listener. The number is 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. You can get your calls in right now. We won't get to them till after the 11:30 newscast, but then we'll be in the clear for calls for about half an hour. 312-981-7200. And if you are listening at some great distance over the internet and want to join us via email, the email address extension 720 at wgnradio.com. Extension 720 as one word, at WGNradio.com. Or the aforesaid, 312-981-7200. The question I was raising before is an impossible one, but it's a fascinating one. I'm sure you've often speculated and thought about it. where does religion come from? Does it come from some sort of human need or some human aspect of our special nervous system or what have you? Or is it rather somehow eternally, inevitably arising again and again, not so much out of human need, but because something is trying to reach us?
Well, I don't really feel competent to talk about this kind of question, but you know, there are confessions one can make about the origin of religion, and that, you know, it's a person's relationship with the God who has influenced his or her life. But I think it is interesting that religion is such a universal phenomenon, even though it takes such diverse forms, such remarkably diverse forms. But, so, you know, what? No doubt, people have much more intelligent things to say about it than I do. But it is a remarkable fact, I think, that it's so universal.
Well, I'm speaking as not as an expert, but as a layman. But I have read up on this subject at a very scientific level, involving neuroscience, but also in cultural terms and that sort of thing. It is universal. And there is a God consciousness about human beings, and I think it's part of our wiring. And for that reason and for other reasons, I do believe in God, and I think it is part of the blueprint, the human blueprint. It's just simply there. It may take different forms, and people may think of not just one God but several gods and various different kinds of stories, but I think there is a God consciousness in humanity. And atheists work really hard to try to deny that or divert it into another direction.
I quite agree. I think that it is hardwired, if you want. But not only is it hardwired, it may very well be hardwired in a way that is attuned to some external or larger persisting reality. But how to represent that reality, how to image it, is what religious disputation is all about. Even within religions, Protestants have been falling upon one another for many, many, many centuries, arguing about how to conceive God. Mm-hmm. And Christians and Jews and Muslims, all deriving from the same narrative source, have been in deep disagreement all this time. The Muslims say that we're all peoples of the book, but somehow they don't have much present regard for the real doctrinal content of, or for that matter, even the moral definitions that you get in Christianity or in Judaism.
Well, I'm not troubled by disagreements. There's disagreements always at different levels, and that's fine. It's like a quest for knowledge and a struggle to understand
better.
And
as you've been pointing out, there were deep disagreements between the Jews of the first century
BC. Of course. And among the Christians themselves as they hammered out their own understandings of the significance of Jesus and so on. But what I don't like and distresses me is when it turns into violence or hatred or discrimination and racism and things like that. That's not right. That's not what God is all about. And at that point, people are crossing the line and they're being very self-destructive.
Yet there is a strange phenomenon. Sociology types are very aware of this and write about it, that there is a decline, at least of conventional religion in the West. The fact is, as you well know, if you go to one of the great cathedrals of Western Europe, Notre Dame is as good a place to go as any, not the one that you work at, but the one in Paris. There isn't much attendance, even for Sunday Mass. Half of the people who are in Notre Dame de Paris are American tourists on Sunday morning.
Yeah.
So does that mean that somehow the religious impulse in human beings is beginning to diminish? Or does it mean that it's simply taking new forms, which are better gratified in spiritual bookstores than in great cathedrals?
Well, I would think, you know, again, this isn't really something I study, but I would think that it's being redirected not to these historical, conventional ways of expressing worship, but that perhaps that doesn't speak to people as much today as it might have in previous times. But I doubt that the religious impulse itself is in danger.
It takes out the forms, is what's
right.
Yeah. Some of them are not classified as religion, but
part of the problem in a lot of seminaries, theological seminaries in North America right now are talking about this and very concerned. And it's more of a cultural problem where the church, and if I can speak in general terms, hasn't always been sensitive to changes and developments within culture. And so a lot of churches are perceived as irrelevant. And so we have young people, people in their teens, 20s, 30s, young families, and why do I want to go to church? They see it as irrelevant, but it doesn't mean they've lost interest in spirituality or in asking the big question about, you know, why am I here? What's life all about? What's God like? What does God expect of us? There's still that sense of godness and interest in spirituality. But they're just Protestants and Catholics alike, and I think Jews too. What's the point of the church or what's the point of the synagogue? And so I think the church needs to start thinking through that and ask themselves, well, wait a minute, how do we become relevant again?
Is there conceivably any evidence of strands or strains or secret impulses toward what we would now label as atheism within the Dead Sea Scrolls?
Well, I would say no. There are in the Psalms it's mentioned, you know, in the Psalms in the Bible, talking about people who say there is no God, and people debate does that mean that they really are denying the existence of God, or does it mean that they don't have an experience of God, they don't experience His presence, or something like that? But that they're dealing with questions like that, I don't see any evidence of that sort in the scrolls.
What was happening when Christianity began to grow and spread throughout the Roman Empire was within pagan culture was a growing skepticism and disorientation with regard to the classic polytheism. And I think that really helped prepare the way. In fact, Judaism itself was deeply respected and was very popular. Proselytes, people, God-fearers attending the synagogue. The idea that there's actually one God and that creation is good and that he has a moral code, you might say, that actually makes a lot of sense and promotes a better society. That was very attractive to many pagans. And so in a sense, the world was just right for the appearance of the Christian faith and its mission within the Roman Empire. As polytheism, what I would regard as a very fractured understanding of God, a defective understanding of God, even though there was that same spiritual impulse. And so the Christian message entered that context and was very successful and spread in the right way without force of arms. Christians didn't go marching around conquering like the city of Rome or something. But in three centuries, its message was well received, and paganism slowly retreated and disintegrated, the polytheism that it was.
We're about to pause for an update on the news, but it is time now to fully and strongly invite telephone calls. Some lines are taken. Some are still available. If you want to join us, you should be acting instantly by calling 312-961-7200. 981-7200. I'm still getting used to our new prefix. 312-981-7200, the number for email, extension 720 at WGNradio.com. And now to the WGN newsroom.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we're going to go directly to the phones in just a moment. I did tell you that the names, of course, of our two guests, but I haven't given them a chance to say much about their publications. Most of their publications are scholarly. That is to say, they're read by their colleagues more than by the general public. But both have done very well-reviewed popular works as well. One by James Vanderkam is titled The Dead Sea Scrolls Today. I was looking at portions of it this very day and found it quite fascinating. Who's the publisher on that?
Erdmann's in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Craig Edwards has one, which I fear I haven't read, but I understand it is just what it says to be, what the title says it is, A Guide to the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Yes, that's right. Published by B&H Publications. Yes.
Mm-hmm. You said it's rather pictorial as well.
Yes, full of color pictures. And I understand you can get the deluxe edition and a box of crayons will be added.
And now we're going to go to the phones, 312-591-7200. I want a few more calls than I've got, so get them in quickly. Good friends of the program know that we depend as much upon your calls as upon the guests. 312-591-7200. And first up is Cheryl, who joins us at WGN Radio. Good evening.
Oh, good evening, gentlemen. Wonderful and interesting guest tonight, Milton. If I studied Jesus' boyhood, would I read about his bar mitzvah, basically reading from the scrolls in front of the congregation, and also about the holidays he celebrated, probably Hanukkah?
Well, we know he celebrated Passover, and we had a rather unusual Passover the last time around.
Well, thank you for the question. We should assume that Jesus observed the holidays that the Jewish people observed, who were devout and Torah observant. And I don't think there would have been anything unusual or strange about Jesus's upbringing or anything that would have seemed peculiar to his contemporaries. So he would have observed the holidays that other Jewish people observed in that time.
And Hanukkah would have been an established Jewish holiday by then, I guess.
I think so, yes.
The miracle of the lamp in the temple goes back to earlier Greek domination.
Yes, that's right. The struggle to liberate Israel and to cleanse the temple.
And the Gospel of John mentions Jesus being present at the Hanukkah celebration one year. So during his adulthood, he's mentioned as observing the festival.
And he is holding a Seder at the Last Supper, in essence, is he not?
As it's presented in some of the Gospels, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what about when he was 13 years old? Bar mitzvah.
But we don't know if that was a bar mitzvah. All we're told, in fact, Jesus was 12 is what we're actually told. But he's in the temple precincts, and he's discussing theology and scripture with teachers, and they see him as a rather promising young lad and are impressed by his learning. Now, what was that suggesting or implying, that a bar mitzvah was right around the corner? It's possible, but it is not explicitly stated.
It's actually just reading from the scrolls in front of the congregation. So he probably, whether it was called bar mitzvah, it was something he probably participated in.
Yes, I think that's likely.
Mm-hmm. You know, it really is. Thank you, ma'am, for the call. It really is worth noting that actually a bar mitzvah conducted today for the 13-year-old boy who goes up to the front. And he's reading from the Torah. And the Torah is in scroll form.
Yeah.
You unroll the scroll to the appropriate day.
Mm-hmm.
I've done that myself.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I don't suppose, is a scroll sort of document used in any Christian worship as far as we know?
No, certainly not today. And perhaps they were used in the very earliest ones. Yeah. I don't recall that we have specific evidence about that.
But in all Jewish synagogues, even in Reform synagogues, the Torah is in scroll form.
Yes, and that would include Messianic congregations, Jewish Christians.
Ah, right.
And they'll do the same thing unroll the scroll, and there'd be a reading.
How interesting. We go back to the phones on 312-591-7200. Jim is next. Good evening. You're on the air.
Hi, Professor Rosenberg. I have a question for Professor Vanderkamp. In the Dead Sea Scrolls today, he makes reference to two different versions of some of the books that are presented in the scrolls. One closely related to the Masoretic text, and another group closer to the Greek translation. And I wonder if I'm a reader, longtime reader. Wonder if there is any more of these text differences noted recently.
Well, that's a good question. We've been talking tonight about the many copies of scriptural books that are found among the scrolls, and a good example of the phenomenon you are talking about, where we have we could call them different editions of scriptural books. A very good example is the book of Jeremiah, in which, as you indicated, some of our copies from the scrolls are quite similar to what we know in the official Hebrew text, the Masoretic text. And in other cases, the text on the scroll is similar to what we have in the Greek translation. And this is true for the book like Jeremiah. It's probably true for some other books, too. But I think what's important to say here is that we do have these different editions of scriptural books, but they differ about some textual matters. I don't think we have cases where they differ in content, where you could say, you know, the teaching is different because of the different edition.
And would you further say then, you know, that they would present or presented no problem to you know, contemporary certainly the Essenes, but contemporary Jews to have the two different versions presented to them or have access to them.
Right. I think that's correct. That we have no indication this bothered anyone, and in fact, we have some indication in a text or two that they were aware of variant readings and really didn't consider them a problem, but considered them an opportunity to have some more text to interpret.
Sir, we thank you for the call. Let's go directly to the next call, that being Adam, who joins us at WGN Radio. Good evening.
Hello. Great to speak with you both. You gentlemen were speaking earlier about Western civilization's progression towards away from traditional religious institutions. And I think that this can be attributed towards, you know, cultures are different, you know, cultures changed, and the way people live their lives are different than they have been before. And people no longer need these structured institutions and these structured teachings and these structured rules to connect with God. It does not jive with people the same way it used to. People can connect with the Lord being virtuous and being good people without needing rules and these set things and set things to be doing and within their religion. It doesn't jive the same way. They can connect with the Lord just between them and the Lord and being the love between that and just the connection they have with the Lord and not needing.
That's, I gather, what you do. Is that the case?
Well, in a way, I try, you know, always, I mean, I'm 18, I'm, you know, trying to understand, you know, question all of these things, and my dad often speaks to me about, you know, if he was raised as a Catholic, you know, in a Catholic school and everything, and I was raised as a Catholic, but he often speaks about, you know, if you're able to live a life, you know, of a good person, you know, doing good onto others and, you know, being a good person.
Sure.
The Lord, you know, will...
I wonder, that's an interesting contribution you've made. I wonder, you're both involved regularly with students, perhaps more graduate students than undergraduates, I'm not sure, but still, do you encounter this from young people you know?
Yes, actually, I hear that expressed. I'm a Protestant, and Protestants hear the same kind of thing. The idea that, well, you know, I can worship God my own way and I can develop my own theology or something like that. I don't need to be part of a structured church.
I think that's right. You do hear that sort of thing. And
can they say that even at the University of Notre Dame?
Sure. And certainly I believe that's something to be respected because I'm sure that's the case. I do think, though, that there is a rich contribution to be made by practicing one's faith in a community. You know, I can say that for myself, and I think that is an important aspect. That doesn't mean, however, that it's an easy thing to find that community that might be right for you. Hope you can find it, but it's not always an easy thing. I know that.
We are about to pause a last quick round of commercials and then right back to the phones. I see a few lines available now. If you've been trying to reach us, do certainly make another quick try. The number remains 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200, and for email, extension 720 at WGNradio.com.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we go directly back to our two very special guests of the evening, Professors Craig Evans and James Vanderkam. Craig Evans is a biblical scholar located at the Divinity School of Acadia University in Nova Scotia. James Vanderkam is a scholar located at, they're both, of course, full professors and hold name chairs, and he is located at the University of Notre Dame. It took me some years to learn to say the University of Notre Dame rather than Notre Dame University.
Mm-hmm.
A number of Notre Dame friends have insisted that I get that.
Yes.
I do it that way.
That's right.
And we go back to the phones. 312-981-7200. Next up is Evelyn, and you are on the air. Good evening.
Good evening. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, ma'am.
I'm in a Bible study class, and we're studying one of the many books of Paul. And we were asking the question if anybody knew how Paul died, because I understand he was on house arrest. But nobody could really come up with an answer on how he died. I was wondering if any of your guests knew that answer.
Is there a Bible? Is there a New Testament reference to his actual death?
No, there's no New Testament reference to Paul's death.
So.
Where we leave him in the book of Acts is he's in under arrest. But church tradition, and I think it's pretty good tradition, the historian Eusebius tells us that Paul was executed during the reign of Emperor Nero as part of his persecution and mm-hmm. oppression of the Christian movement, probably in the year 65, 67, somewhere in there.
And where do we get the story of the death of Peter?
Same source.
From Eusebius.
Yeah, and other sources, yeah, where he's crucified upside down.
And he requests to be placed upside down.
Yeah, he didn't feel he was worthy to be crucified in the same way that Jesus had been crucified.
Well, what do you do with material of that sort? Do you give it credence, or doesn't it really matter?
Well, I think you take it seriously, but you recognize that it's fairly remote. There's a you know, there's a gap between our earliest historical reference and the event that's being described. So you have to be cautious.
Mm-hmm. We go back to the calls, and next up is Jim with an interesting question. Good evening, sir. You're on the air.
Yes, in the Bible, Jesus always refers to himself as the Son of Man and not the Son of God. You know, why did he do this? And what was the meaning of the term back then of the Son of Man?
Sir, you should turn your radio down because we're going to get double vision of ourselves, so to speak.
The title Son of Man is a really interesting one. We know about it from places like the Book of Daniel, where one like a Son of Man comes. Figure is also known from other literature written around this time, some of the Enoch literature. And the Son of Man appears to be a future figure who will come with the clouds and will be involved in the judgment. And it's quite an exalted title, so that we shouldn't take it as a reference, Jesus referring to his human nature or something like that, but it's quite a exalted title that he takes for himself and does so a number of times, as you indicate.
Our thanks to the caller.
Why didn't he refer to himself as the Son of God, though? Was, you know?
Oh, that's your basic question. All right, let's address that.
Well, I can't. I mean, you know, he claimed to be the Messiah.
We do know, and to be sure, others would have raised the question in just that form, I'm sure.
Well, at his hearing before Caiaphas, the high priest, Jesus is asked explicitly if he is the Messiah, the Son of God. And he says, I am, and you will see the Son of Man. So Son of Man is that exalted figure that Professor Vanderkam referred to. And I think in this occasion, and perhaps in a few other occasions, Jesus is alluding to that Son of Man, that human figure of Daniel 7. And so he's saying yes to the question. He is the Messiah, the Son of God, and he will, next time Caiaphas sees him, he will see him coming in judgment. That's a pretty exalted claim there. And so he is saying he is the Son of God in that occasion.
Have you ever encountered the short story by Anatole France? in which Pontius Pilate is back in Rome. He's retired now. And he encounters a friend of his on someplace in the Forum, I guess. And they chat. And he says, I understand that you were in Palestine, or whatever it's called in Roman sources. He says, yes, I did serve there. And it was interesting, surely a challenging assignment. He says, there's a group around Rome now who are making a lot of fuss about somebody who was supposedly executed by your troops and who had some special claim upon their religious faith. And I believe his name is Jesus. And Pontius, in all simple sincerity, stops and ponders and scratches his head a bit and then says, I do not remember the man. It's Anatole France who's trying to... I'm not quite sure what he's trying to say. But maybe maybe it's his skepticism. Maybe it's his sense of the paradox of human existence. I don't know.
Well, at the time...
It's a striking
idea. You know, at the time of Jesus' execution, there's no reason to think that Pilate would have had special thoughts about him. And it isn't very long after that that Pilate is recalled. And so he probably, you know, we don't know how long he lived. There's legend and myth about that. But he might never have even heard about the Christian movement.
Yeah. Oh, interesting. 312-591-7200 is our number. Our next caller is Mark. And you are on the air, sir. Good evening.
Good evening, Milton. It's 981. Anyway.
What did I say 591 again?
That's 591.
Oh, my goodness. It's taking me a week to get used to this, and I still haven't managed it.
Anyway, a question to your two guests. As ancient as these Dead Sea Scrolls are, do we have any earlier, I mean, in hand, earlier Jewish texts, in other words, actual Jewish texts that survive?
We don't have anything as extensive as this. There are some much briefer texts that go back to an earlier time, but this is the first time that we really have an extensive body of material, you know, so that we have more than an inscription or a very brief text or something like that. So they're not the absolute oldest, but the oldest, most extensive group of texts.
Right. So, in other words, other than a few fragments.
Right. Right.
Well, okay.
Is it the case that some have argued that that outside of the New Testament there is no historic reference to Jesus' existence, except the reference in, I believe it's Tacitus, that the Christians are making trouble and they follow somebody called, and you got a version of Jesus. And then do we have a mention of Jesus by Josephus?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's sometimes assumed, sometimes argued that that is a falsification entered later on.
Yeah, the reference to Jesus in Josephus' Jewish Antiquities, Book 18, has been glossed. But I think the majority view now is that Josephus did refer to Jesus, put to death by Pontius Pilate, and strangely enough, his following continues. And it's just some Christian scribe embellished it with some confessional material. So it's probably an authentic but tampered with passage. Mm. Then you have, as you just said, Milt, Tacitus, also Suetonius, and a few other second century writers who are not Christians who refer to Jesus.
Because they're referring to Christians as a source of trouble in the town.
But they seem to know things about the origins of the story, too, that it appears to be independent. They use different kinds of words to describe, like, but they don't use stauro'o, the verb for crucify. They use skolopizo instead, to pierce with a stake or something like that. So there's some indications of maybe an independent stream of knowledge about these Christians and their origins.
I've mentioned your two books. What else is available for people who really want to know more about the Dead Sea Scrolls and their pertinence to their own religious life?
Well, there really is a long list of books, introductory books about the Dead Sea Scrolls. One that was used for a long time was by Frank Cross, one of the original scroll scholars who just recently has died. His was widely used and is still widely used today by people.
The one by Edmund Wilson, though it reads well, and he was a great writer, but it's all wrong, isn't it?
Yeah, I wouldn't. Yeah, no, I don't mean to disparage the man, but Wilson's book, Dupont-Somme, these books are terribly out of date and quirky in some ways.
Gentlemen, I thank you most sincerely for joining us. It's been a memorably interesting program to me and I think to our listeners. Our guests have been James Van Der Kan of the University of Notre Dame and Craig Evans of Acadia University. We'll be back again on tomorrow night at 10 o'clock. Until then, thanks to all for listening and a most cordial good night.